Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Syndicated News, and I'm Raymond F. Rivas, Chief Financial Editor. My firm is Atherton Wealth Planning. Our broker-dealer is LPL Financial Services. And you're listening to syndicatednews.net, brought to you this evening by Shadow Operations, LLC. And we have a very special guest this evening, the renowned Mr. Lincoln Anderson. Lincoln, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thanks a lot for having me on, Raymond.
Oh, it's our pleasure. I'm going to speak a moment or two about you, Lincoln. Lincoln Anderson is a chief director, chief investment officer, and chief economist for LPL Financial. From the Reagan years to the present, Lincoln Anderson has provided an in-depth research and guidance on the global economy and financial markets. He's a frequently cited and widely recognized economist. Lincoln is often featured in Bloomberg, CNBC broadcasts, regularly quoted on the Wall Street Journal, and is regularly published in various industrial publications. Lincoln has been with LPL since 1999 as Senior Vice President and Chief Investment Officer, and in the year 2000 he was promoted to the Managing Director and Chief Investment Officer and Chief Economist. He has extensive economic and investment experience. He was also associated with Fidelity Investments in Boston. He was with Bear Stearns & Company in New York, and from 1992 to 86, Lincoln Anderson was a senior staff economist at the Council of Economic Advisors in the Reagan administration. Lincoln, it's a pleasure having you as our guest this evening. And before we really get started, besides those wonderful credentials that you have, can you speak a moment or two about yourself?
Well, first, I don't want to have time reversed here. You said 1992 to 1986. In 1982 to 86, I was in the Reagan administration.
Well, that does make a difference.
I'm a numbers guy. So, anyway, I'm sorry, what was your question?
The question is, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself besides the credentials that you carry?
Well, I've been in the studying financial markets and fiscal and monetary policy for a long time here, and so I certainly have seen a lot of different financial crises and real crises in the real economy, and boy, we're going through something I've never seen before right now.
It's a cyclone. By the way, I did want to tell you that your team, the UCLA Bruins, beat my Stanford football team on Saturday. So I know you feel bad about that.
Oh, terrible. I apologize profusely.
Lincoln, as the director of LPL Financial Services, can you tell us why LPL's business model has just kept the firm out of harm's way during these troubling times in Wall Street?
Yeah, well, we are... Have a completely different business model. The broker-dealer has no leverage. It has no proprietary products. It has no investment banking conflicts. It has not created any hedge funds that have blown up or anything like that. Our business is supporting advisors, about 11,500 of them around the country, like you. And so the whole firm is aimed at providing unbiased, non-proprietary advice and products in an open architecture, mostly open architecture environment. We do a lot of due diligence and try to screen out what we think are relatively risky products that in open architecture environment, so that you and the roughly 11,000 other financial advisors can give great advice to the clients on how to construct and maintain portfolios.
And, you know, during these days, it's a wonderful comfort to know that it's a firm that sticks by its word and does provide the services to clients without endangering them in any way, shape, or form. And so that's the comfort that I have, and I'm sure all of the rest of the other individuals.
There's plenty of danger out here.
there is.
But I mean, it's not like we're generating danger so far, and knock on wood, but I see no reason why we would. We haven't need any help from the Federal Reserve, the Treasury. It's just our business model doesn't require any of that sort of thing.
Lincoln, this morning I was listening to and watching CNN, and I was watching the Fox News, and the impression that I have and the real concern is the American public is concerned and full of fear about the economy. And so from your perspective, what do you see as the main concern that the American public right now is carrying with it, and do you think that that concern is justified?
Oh, absolutely. In our opinion, earlier I had thought we might skate by and just be able to miss a recession and go into a flat spot for a while. But when oil prices got up to nearly $150, it delivered a delayed hit to the real economy that's now showing up. And companies, some of the major chemical companies, reporting that there's big slackening in demand because of their attempts to pass through big energy price increases, which one of their big components of their costs, through. And so that's hammering in all sorts of different areas, from fertilizer to chemicals and all over the place. Even though oil prices have now come back down, we're getting this delayed impact from that huge price spike. And then the coup de grace was delivered with the complete seizing up in credit markets that occurred in the second half of September after AIG and Lehman failed.
Mm-hmm.
And that was created just major dislocations in credit markets. And I think, in our opinion, pushed us into a recession. It looks like it began in September. And a number of statistics worsened considerably, and we're looking at a fourth quarter that's probably a distinct drop in GDP and some sizable drops in employment. So there's plenty of reason for concern. There are some bright spots in all of this, but which we can get into. But I don't think that we're certainly not, in my opinion, going into the Great Depression too, or anything remotely resembling that. But we are going to take a significant hit from the financial market meltdown and the delayed impact of that huge spike in crude oil prices earlier this year.
Lincoln, one of the concerns that I've been talking to some of my own clients is that, as a matter of fact, we were having coffee down at a local coffee shop. And we were all thinking about and talking about that none of the funds that were supposed to be, broken out, those $700 billion, seems to be being used right now. Do you have any ideas to why that money has not been put out into the banking sector and into the economy itself? It seems to be held back. Is that a concern?
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, there are, the Congress put a lot of oversight and controls, and rightly so, I think, on how that money mm-hmm. would be used. And it takes time to set up the processes and structures
mm-hmm.
to meet those oversight criteria and controls and restrictions. And I think as a taxpayer, I certainly view that as a positive. But it's not true that all of it's not being put to work. I mean, in the wake of the, we can talk about that later whenever you like, about the credit default swaps
mm-hmm.
just imploding. This is a gigantic unregulated marketplace with very little transparency. In the wake of AIG and Lehman, it just completely imploded in the space of about a week and
mm-hmm.
created enormous counterparty risk, and really did cause credit markets to seize up. That the governments around the world, including the U.S., put the troubled asset,
mm-hmm.
rescue plan, the TARP, in the back seat, and switch to direct capital injections into the banks. And so we've done that for $125 billion into the nine of the money center banks, and the Treasury's announced they intend to continue that program
mm-hmm.
with another $125 billion into a number for smaller banks.
Do you
believe, and
I think this is one of my major concerns. You know, they keep bantering the $700 billion that's going to be used. Do you think this is all the money that the government's going to need, or do you think this is going to be the beginning of their sometime in the future coming back and saying, no, we need another $300 billion, or do you think that the $700 billion is going to suffice to solve this problem?
Well, to be quite honest, and I always am and will be, I don't know, but I suspect it will not. And I, you know, it's the old in for a penny, in for a pound. If need be, they need more money, I suspect they will go back to Congress, and I would think that Congress would approve it, in that, you know, the stakes are quite high now. As a Reagan Republican, I got to tell you, I'm not in favor of many of these steps from, you know, a free market economic perspective, but it seems to me that a lot of this is quite necessary. And bear in mind that this is not only a Treasury function as well. We have enormous amounts of money being created and put to work by the Federal Reserve at this point.
I was listening to Laffer this morning. He was railing on, I think, on Fox Channel. And he certainly gave you a lot to think about, you know, whether or not there were other options considered. But we'll never know because, you know, we'll, I'm sure sometime in 50 years from now, they're going to come back and give us an idea to what was discussed. But can you speak for a moment or two about the underlying factors that did that causes global financial markets that teeter? And, you know, what do you think is going to be done to rectify this situation, Lincoln?
Well, you know, sad to say, we have had the global financial system sorely tested in this process, and a number of very large parts of the system have been found wanting, have just shattered like glass. I mean, we started out with, you know, 4, 5, 6 years ago, whenever, with a bunch of mortgage originators who were very poorly regulated, by federal and other regulatory bodies, originating mortgages that, in hindsight, or I mean even at the time, there are plenty of web pages you can find from the FDIC and other places saying these mortgages, these subprimes and Alt-A's were a bad, bad idea. And so there was a lot of very poor mortgage origination being done. So that was sort of step one, and then step two was putting a lot of these mortgages, subprimes and the like, into these very complex financial structures called CDOs. And these CDOs had multiple tiers and all sorts of stuff going on in them that made them very unmanageable. And then, in other words, if you did start having defaults, it was very difficult to, you know, adjust terms and do things because, you know, different people own different pieces of the same mortgage, and so that was incredibly, in retrospect, silly thing to do. And then we had rating agencies who, in retrospect, had no idea what they were doing in these complex securities, who were rating parts of them at least as AAA, which they clearly, in retrospect, they were not. And then we had a number of financial institutions that were out there packaging and selling these securities with various, you know, tranches, and they ended up with a lot of these securities and some of the poor quality pieces of these securities on their balance sheets that they couldn't sell to other players, and they kept doing it over and over again, so they ended up with leverage in the 30 to 40 times and very, very risky portfolios. And this is a highly concentrated process, and for the most part, in number, in my opinion, for the most part, in a number, in just, you know, not a large number of financial institutions, but with immense leverage. And so when things started to fall apart, as house prices begin to fall and foreclosures picked up, then the risk on these large financial institutions' balance sheets just exploded. So that's step one. And actually, I mean, it sounds horrible enough, but that was only a small part of the damage. And So we were going along dealing with that crisis, and then we came to about mid-September, and, you know, the Treasury was busy working on the troubled asset rescue program and stuff that was supposed to solve all of that.
Yeah.
And then we, you know, had folks looking at the books of AIG, the parent company of the various insurance subsidiaries. The insurance subsidiaries are still viewed as quite sound, but the parent company had done a lot of insurance of these CDOs, these complex mortgage,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah.
And they had been insuring them, and they also had set up, is my understanding, a pretty strange and absolutely, to my mind, crazy structure where if they if their credit rating fell, then they had to raise capital and raise, you know, to make sure they had enough collateral for the insurance they were writing on these securities. So they got caught in just a total squeeze. It was a downward spiral, and so that's what forced the parent company of AIG into bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
Then I think it was one day or maybe 2 days later, Lehman went bankrupt for a variety of reasons, including some of these, but a variety of reasons. And so what happened with AIG is when they went bankrupt, they were insuring these CDOs in what's called the credit default swap CDS
mm-hmm.
marketplace, which is a gigantic unregulated marketplace. And then when Lehman failed, they were on both sides of the trade. They were both doing insurance, and also they had their debt insured in the CDS marketplace. And after a few days, market participants were thought about what the implications of that were, and then they realized that there was just unlimited counterparty risk out there. And it just caused the whole marketplace to implode, and for a lot of banks and financial institutions quit doing business with each other.
That just sounds absolutely terrifying. Lincoln, I'm going to step away for a moment or two. I have to identify our radio program, if you don't mind, for a moment or two, and then I'll be right back to you. This is Syndicated News, and I'm Raymond F. Rivas, Chief Financial Editor. My firm is Atherton Wealth Planning. And if you wish, you can email me at Rivas@syndicatednews.net, and that's R-I-V-A-S. And you're listening to Syndicated News, or Syndicated News Net, brought to you again by Shadow Operations LLC. And now back to our special guest, Mr. Lincoln Anderson. Lincoln, I did want to talk a little bit about the European Central Bank. What is that?
Before we get to that, could I just back up? Because I've been talking about these credit default swaps, and I'd just like to explain what they are.
Yeah, I'd like to find out what they are, too. I think so would most
terms,
of the listeners.
I've been talking about how it just completely, you know, cratered the financial system globally. And so I think it's worth spending just a moment talking about.
Well, it is. It's very important.
What I think is a simplified but not overly simplified and I think accurate description of what they're about.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose you had a $100,000 mortgage on your home. There's this over-the-counter marketplace where people can bet for and against default on various securities. So you could end up with, and, you know, this is a hypothetical, but you could end up with two people. One of them's betting that you're going to default on your mortgage, your $100,000 mortgage, and another person who's betting that you won't. And, you know, the person who's betting you won't is, quote, insuring your mortgage. And
yes.
They can do that, and you wouldn't know that they were doing that. And it gets worse. Not only could those two people bet for and against you defaulting on your mortgage, but you could have hundreds or thousands or many thousands of people and millions of dollars betting for and against you defaulting on your mortgage. You could end up with the notional value of the credit default swaps on one side or the other being many, many times the value of your mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
And not only would you not know that they were betting for and against you defaulting on your mortgage, but they wouldn't know that other people are doing the same thing. Because it's all over the counter, which means it's not in an open exchange and subject to no regulation or open, you know, listing of the transactions. So that's a, so, you know, when Lehman failed, for example, I am told, and nobody knows for sure, though we're going to get, we got somewhat of an accounting, I think, late today, but I haven't seen it yet, that the notional value, that the value of the swap agreements against Lehman's debt were more than four times as big as the face value of Lehman's debt. So when that happens, when it's more than one or so times, then we've left the, we're spreading around the default risk and entered into a, you know, massive casino.
Yeah.
And so the supposedly, though nobody knows for sure, the total credit default swaps market worldwide is something like $60 trillion. So it's a huge piece of the financial market that in this, in that second half of September was, again, sorely tested, found wanting, and shattered like a piece of glass. And that's why I say the counterparty risk went up enormously, because none of the banks or other financial players in this marketplace had any idea what their counterparties' exposures, you know, really were. And so it really caused credit markets to seize up. And I know my example sounds completely crazy, you know, but that's pretty much what it was. And it's, you know, one of those things among many in the global financial market that's just been turned out to be a, unfortunately, a failed system, part of the system.
Lincoln, just I'm just as I'm hearing you speak, I guess I'm kind of wondering, is there anybody who is keeping track as to where it started, what was going on, how it was sliced and diced, how they bet for, how they bet against? Was there any sort of guiding hand that at least kept track as to how all the pieces fit, or was it just out there in the middle of Netherland, just kind of just existing? What did you see? Do you see that anybody was accounting for all of this items happening?
No. The credit default swap marketplace was totally over the counter. There was no centralized exchange for it, and again, so I'm sure on a go-forward basis, as part of our financial market and regulatory reform, which, you know, obviously there's, you know, a lot of necessary pieces that need to be done, and I've got a long laundry list, but one of them is that marketplace, the over-the-counter CDS marketplace, is highly likely to be going away.
Lincoln, you know what this sounds to me? Back in 1998, remember we had that long-term Capital Management Corporation, I think it was in New Jersey or whatever it was. They had these two geniuses who were running the whole program and all those mathematicians. And it came to the point whereby, in a moment's notice, or in a moment, that almost took the United States over the edge because of the complication of the way the things were wound together. And it seems to me when they get these exotic ideas that it just seems to lose control, and it becomes a monument all by itself that creates all these horrendous problems for not only for you and I as taxpayers, but then, you know, all of the rest of the folks, including the government, has to step in to protect these people from themselves. Is that kind of sometimes what happens? It goes, you know, they put these models together.
We just have not learned. We, you know, in the failure of long-term capital, what that was a levered bet on credit spreads. And as I've said many, many times, never, ever, ever invest in a levered bet on credit spreads, because sooner or later, you know, something will go wrong in that credit spread. And with heavy leverage, it will, you know, just blow up. And that happened in long-term capital, in my opinion, because they had a levered bet on where they were long mortgages, which have higher yields, and short treasuries, equivalent maturity treasuries, which have lower yields, and so they, with leverage, were able to cream off the spreads. But the problem with that is that if interest rates moved up or down a fair amount, either way, it didn't matter, then that levered credit spread blew up. And that's, and you know, with Bear Stearns and their hedge funds, and actually, I think, with their whole portfolio, what happened was they had the same thing on. Only they not only had a levered bet on mortgages, but they had a levered bet on low-quality mortgages. So they
mm-hmm.
not only had what's called a convexity bet on, but they also had a credit bet on in size. And so there's a takeaway here. It's just never, ever invest in hedge funds that have these levered bets on these credit spreads.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in retrospect, long-term capital is very small compared to what we're going through now. I mean, this is a much bigger deal than that one. But, you know, it's just, I think as opposed to back then where everybody, you know, like tidied up the mess and moved on,
mm-hmm.
this time around we're going to see major, major regulatory changes and changes in the structure of financial markets as a result.
Do you feel that we're addressing this credit crunch or this credit crisis in the United States in a way that's going to resolve our problems in a short period of time, or do you feel that they're going down the wrong road? What are your feelings about the way this credit crisis is being handled?
Well, I think in the main they're doing a decent job. You know, we've been improvising as we go along here, the Treasury, Paulson, and Bernanke, but I think in the main they're doing a decent job. I mourn the loss. I mean, there are many things in this that I mourn. I love deposit insured. Let me just start the list. I love deposit insured community banks.
Mm-hmm.
I think having deposit insurance on community banks who know their customers and originate loans to people they know and keep them
mm-hmm.
on their books and do all of that are fine institutions. But when you create these gigantic commercial banks who have a very difficult time knowing their customers. And they're backed up by deposit insurance, and they are totally integrated institutions with all the conflicts from investment banking and proprietary products and the like. I view those as more of a 19th century anachronism
mm-hmm.
that it would have been nice to get away from. But the repeal of Glass-Steagall, and I know some people say it was a good idea, I disagree vehemently.
Mm-hmm.
The appeal of Glass-Steagall, which allowed the integration of these giant institutions, and now with this credit crisis, we've created even more enormous financial institutions, and I don't think that's a step in the right direction. So, you know, that's one of the things that is going to, and they're going to be heavily regulated.
Very troubling, Lincoln. Very troubling.
You know, there's some people are complaining that. The Treasury is not taking voting shares in these financial institutions. In my opinion, I think they're going to be so closely regulated that voting shares are really unnecessary here. That's one sort of setback
mm-hmm.
that's kind of, you know, that does put us taxpayers at risk and, you know, creates what I think is a suboptimal financial structure. But clearly there's so many pieces of the structure that we currently or until recently have had that were monstrously suboptimal
mm-hmm.
that, you know, you have to view a lot of this as a step very suboptimal step in a better direction.
Well, did you watch the Sunday evening of the CBS televised 60-minute program where they had the CEO of the Bank of America? He made the statement that the United States might be entering a state of socialism based on the actions of the Federal Reserve Board and the way the actions of the government. Do you believe that what he said has some merit?
Well, I didn't see his statements and the like, so wouldn't want to speak to Bank of America in particular, but I think to the extent that we are making steps away from, you know, sort of free laissez-faire free market capitalism,
mm-hmm.
boy, there's a bunch of money center banks that have a pretty heavy burden when it comes around to
mm-hmm.
allocating blame. So I think finger pointing at the Federal Reserve for their, quote, their rescue efforts here,
mm-hmm.
is probably not particularly appropriate. There's certainly plenty of finger pointing you could do at them for their lax regulatory oversight over the last
mm-hmm.
6 or 8 years, but I'm not willing to point a finger at them for what they're doing now.
Well, on October the 13th, and I read one of your wonderful letters I sent all my clients. You said, and I'm going to read the quotation. It says, this is what you said. The stock market bottoms usually follow major anti-recession policy actions, not the end of the recession itself. I, along with other folks, I am sure, would love to have a do-over on this astonishingly large hit our financial markets have taken. But that is not the way the world works. We have to do what we have in hand. What did you mean by that?
Well, I'm just saying I'm sure many others would like. I mean, when you get to weak spots at the end of the day, you know, you say, "Gosh, boy, I wish I could go back 12 months and have a do-over,"
mm-hmm.
And you know, go rush and buy a whole bunch of treasury bonds and all that. You know, that kind of regrets that you have in this. But you know, the magnitude and the breadth and the speed, especially from mid-September, with which this hit, is just. I mean, sure, there are a few perma bears who said are going to be all mm-hmm. they are and have been saying, "I told you so." And there are a few very bright people that saw this coming. Warren Buffett, one of them. A credit crisis is magnitude is just very, very hard to predict. Now, that said, you know, we got to take what we've got at this point in time, and I do think. And we can talk more about the economy. I do think there are some significant buffers against a major recession, both in terms of economic policy changes as well as, pretty sound footing for U.S. non-financial corporations, who I think have,
mm-hmm.
at this point in aggregate, super strong balance sheets and have done you know, enormous amount of cost cutting and don't have the excesses that need to, quote, be
mm-hmm.
cured, unquote, by a recession,
mm-hmm.
that will be provide us with a fair amount of buffering as we go through this process. So I look at the marketplace today, and we've got plenty of time to talk about it. It just strikes me that at this point we've got just incredible premium being paid for riskless assets, so treasury bill, note, and bond yields are very, very low,
mm-hmm.
And everybody wants to own riskless assets, and they're willing to pay very high prices for them,
mm-hmm.
in my opinion. And meanwhile, assets that have any risk at all, or you know, mild have become in many instances quite cheap at this point. So, I think. What we have in hand is a situation like that, and it as Warren Buffett has said, it does create opportunities. And there are plenty of them out there, in my opinion, that I would urge folks that are either sitting there in cash or thinking about going to cash to consider all the investment opportunities that are being created as we go along here.
Yeah, that's what you said on your October 16th letter. You also mentioned that in that particular letter, you said that you felt the stocks were looking cheap. You also stated, quote, "I hope we have seen the low, but of course we have no way to know." Well, that rhymes even. My question to you is, should we consider the lead of Warren Buffett and start getting back into the marketplace?
Well, I wouldn't rely 100% on Warren Buffett. I mean, He's a bright guy, but he's made plenty of mistakes, and as have we all. But I do think that this creates cautious buying opportunities. So
mm-hmm.
At LPL Financial, we're advising people who have been either light the equity markets or have been in cash or have been shifted from a balanced portfolio through market action heavily
mm-hmm.
into the bond overweights to consider, dollar cost averaging back into equity markets and other, considered risky asset classes on a nice 3 to 6 month program of moving back in.
Mm-hmm.
I think big bullet bets on really risky securities right now are probably a bad idea. We've seen plenty of $2 stocks that look cheap go to zero, so I wouldn't want to recommend that, but I do think these dislocations have created a lot of opportunities.
I can see that. Again, Lincoln, I have to break away to identify our station, so I'll be back in just a moment or two. This is Syndicated News, and I'm Raymond F. Ravis with our special guest, Mr. Lincoln Anderson. The name of my firm is called Atherton Wealth Planning, and you're listening to syndicatednews.net, brought to you again by Shadow Operations, LLC. And now back to our guest, Mr. Lincoln Anderson. Lincoln, there are some economists, I think, of the market is still extremely volatile. What are your thoughts?
Oh, I think, some folks use volatile as a euphemism for going down. I have always viewed volatility for what it's supposed to mean, which means lots of up and down.
Mm-hmm.
So to the extent that folks are saying it's volatile, meaning they think it's going to go down a lot,
mm-hmm.
It's certainly possible, and we live in highly uncertain times, but I think we do have some pretty compelling valuations in a number
mm-hmm.
of areas. On the other hand, if the meaning there is volatility means we're going to have plenty of up and down on a go-forward basis, I couldn't agree more. I think,
mm-hmm.
We are going to see good days and bad days. We're going to have plenty of days where we're going to get economic statistics that look just plain horrible. I wouldn't rule out more. I have no way of knowing for sure, but I wouldn't rule out that we couldn't have more, significant corporate defaults either in the financial sector or outside of it.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that we're going to have some pretty tough developments internationally. I think Europe has got even bigger problems than we do. And emerging markets, which have just been crushed in terms of their stock market declines,
mm-hmm.
could get crushed some more here. And
mm-hmm.
So there are plenty of reasons. On the other hand, too, we could get plenty of good news here. We haven't talked about it much, who has really, mm-hmm. really, really pumped out, as opposed to in the Great Depression, where they allowed
mm-hmm.
massive contraction in the money supply and liquidity and allowed banks to fail, just fail left and right for no good reason whatsoever back then. This Federal Reserve is really committed to making sure that that banks can meet deposit runs. They're willing
mm-hmm.
to allow banks to fail if they need fail, if they have negative net worth, but if they're willing to meet deposit runs for otherwise sound banks and meet other sorts of runs, and they are have in the process of creating unbelievable expansion of bank reserves and also providing sufficient liquidity to the marketplace for a really big expansion of cash balances for non-financial companies as well.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that, and there's a number of non-financial companies who are actually doing quite well, thank you very much. So there are bright spots and very black spots in front of us that will create a lot of volatility. I'm pretty convinced of that.
Well, Lincoln, what's rather unnerving out here in the West, our newspaper, the San Francisco Chronicle, is doing a series of front-page articles describing, the full-blown fury of the 1930s depression. When you open up or when you look at the front page, they've got people in lines. They've got, they've got tin cans in their or tin cups in their hand, rather, and selling pencils. And so obviously that's not exactly encouraging right there. So you're saying, what you've been saying is that maybe in your opinion, the Federal Reserve Board has taken a different approach this time than the way it was trying to do in the 1930s. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, absolutely. The main thrust of the monetary policy in the 1930s, which was just unbelievably bad, was essentially what they said was the way banks, if they were experiencing a run of depositors, they could come and borrow money at the discount window from the Federal Reserve. Well, back then, the Federal Reserve said, we will not allow you to give us treasury debt that you've got on your balance sheet. We won't take that at all.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if you have a deposit run and you want to meet it by cashing in your treasury securities, the Federal Reserve, to get, borrowed reserves, well, forget it. We're not going to do that. That's not collateral.
Mm-hmm.
We'll accept, which is just crazy. And then they said, we'll only take high investment grade corporate securities. And so as corporations were downgraded, less and less of the bank's balance sheet, the ownership of high grade corporate securities was available. And so, you know, it was very difficult for them to otherwise sound banks to meet deposit runs. And so they just triggered, you know, an increasing wave of failures. And as the failures of banks went on, then more corporate debt was downgraded and, you know, and just avalanched to the downside and caused an enormous contraction in the banking system and a very, very large drop in the money supply. And, I mean, to my mind, that was a principal reason. Oh, and then even worse, I think it was 1934, the Federal Reserve, in just, you know, an unbelievably stupid decision, decided that the best way to enhance the soundness of the banking system was to double reserve requirements.
Oh, my goodness.
And these banks, you know, they didn't have the wherewithal to meet a doubling of reserve requirements, and so it triggered what was turning into a pretty solid recovery in 32 and 33 into another huge wave of bank failures after they doubled reserve requirements, and then another really sizable downturn in the economy, which made the whole period labeled the Great Depression. This time around, the Federal Reserve is not doing anything remotely resembling that. They are headed in the opposite direction in a gigantic way, creating enormous expansion of bank reserves. Bank reserves are, which are, you know, before this all started, say, 6 or 8 months ago, were about $45 billion, are now at about $250 billion and
on
their way, given their announced actions, to more than $1 trillion in the next few months.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is big money going the other direction, $1 trillion in bank reserves.
You know, in the past,
yes.
I was going to say, in the past, there's always been bank failures, a natural thing that happens. It's like any other business that you're in. But now it's been, when Schumer went ahead and pointed that finger at that bank in San Diego, people got the feeling that, my God, all the banks are failing. And instead, it's seemed to be a natural thing that happens every year. Some businesses go under, some businesses don't. But the way they made things appear, that all the banks were on the verge of going under any second. Is it natural for banks sometimes, from time to time, to go under from whatever reasons? Or is that an unusual situation?
Oh, yeah. I mean, bank failures are a natural phenomenon with bank management teams or local or regional conditions worsening, or, you know, for a variety of reasons. And a bank, which, you know, away from the money center banks, you know, and the investment banks, you know, they don't have the 30, 40 times leverage, but, you know, they have 10 times leverage and things like that. So if things really go wrong, then they can fail. The failures this time around have been certainly bigger, and just because more people got sucked in, you know, and the banking system got sucked into the notion that, hey, if Indy Bank or somebody else is doing alt A's or subprimes, maybe you ought to do that too. And so that's, you know, created what they call in the business a race for the bottom, where you're raising risk and you're on the, you know, the lending side of your balance sheet. For many community banks really didn't get involved in that, and frankly, they're doing just fine. A lot of them are doing just fine. Actually, they have pretty good prospects, and that's why the regional bank part of the S&P 5 or the S&P 500 or 1500 mm-hmm. stock price index has done pretty well here. You know, they've got a steep yield curve now, so borrow mm-hmm. short, lend long works again, mm-hmm. which is, you know, the main tenet of the, you know, small medium sized banks. And you know you borrow short with deposits and you lend longer term and you get an interest rate spread. They used to have a lot of people going out to these non-bank mortgage originators who had these ludicrous, terms, you know, easy standards and lax stuff and no down payments and all that mm-hmm. sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Those folks are gone now, so they're coming back to their regular old banks. There were a lot of small and medium-sized businesses that used to go direct to the commercial paper market for loans and bypass the banks, and so now they're, because the commercial paper market's experiencing some difficulty, they're coming back to the banks for loans. And
Lincoln, I'm going to ask you, well, the American dollar seems to be benefiting from this awful crisis that we have. What are the reasons that the American dollar is suddenly starting to be strengthening?
Well, the appreciation there started well before. It was, you know, we're about three, four months into dollar appreciation. One thing is it just got, in my opinion, unbelievably, ludicrously cheap. You know, we went to a record low back about 3 months ago in the what the Federal Reserve calls their major currency index, the dollar exchange rate against the major currencies, you know, euro, mm-hmm. UK, Canadian dollar, and yen, and the like. And you know, it was so undervalued, in my opinion, that U.S. companies just had this enormous, and still do, even with the rebound,
mm-hmm.
enormous competitive advantage in international markets. And so I think it was just fundamental factors that started the dollar recovery. And then as this crisis hit, you know, we have not appreciated, we've depreciated against Japan. Because
mm-hmm.
for all the problems, and there are tons of them in Japan economically, the one thing they didn't have is they didn't have a whole bunch of financial institutions melting down. So we haven't appreciated that much against, at all, really, against the yen. But against the euro and pound sterling and some other countries, we have appreciated a fair amount, recovered a fair amount, because the problems they've got in their banking systems and also in their economies as a result of our competitive advantage in exporting
mm-hmm.
to
mm-hmm.
third parties is just very large. So that's why I'm a little worried, more worried about overseas investing. We recommended LPL Financial to our advisors to not take the advice of these people who say put 50% of your retirement savings in international investments
mm.
or to put 30% in commodities or, you know, that kind of stuff.
I'm going to switch horses on you a little bit, Lincoln, because
yep.
as I understand that the OPEC folks are going to be having an emergency meeting, I believe on Friday, regarding,
yeah,
you know, the plunging price of oil. And Nigeria and Venezuela have grown heavily dependent on their income, you know, from this commodity. You know, what do you foresee is going to be the outcome of this meeting, especially with the plunging price of oil? Do you think that if the OPEC countries decide to reduce their output by a million barrels or whatever their target's going to be, do you think it's going to work?
Well, I certainly hope, and I think it will not. I mean, if as angry as folks are at some of the shenanigans at money center, investment banks, and the like, boy, it should pale in comparison to the anger at OPEC for all this price fixing and crazy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were really unable with output expansions to contain the oil price rise on the upside, and I do not think they will contain it on the downside. We are experiencing an industrial world, probably a global contraction
mm-hmm.
will go on for, you know, two or three quarters or perhaps more, and a significant slowdown in emerging markets like China and India and the like. And, you know, and as a result of that, the emerging markets and oil producers, you know, especially the oil producing countries, are just getting really hammered. The Russian stock market is down, and I think appropriately so, a country mile at this point.
Well, I was reading, Lincoln, that the Deutsche Bank predicted, you know, yesterday that the anemic about 1.2% growth in the world economy next year, what they're predicting, could drive the price of oil prices as low as $50 a barrel, you know, about a third of their summertime high. I know you feel bad about that.
I wouldn't quibble with that forecast at all, but I would quibble with, I've watched some of these Wall Street guys go from forecasting that oil prices were going to go to $200 a barrel.
I remember that.
To now saying they're going to go to 50 now. I mean, so there's a lot of, you know, and then we had a whole bunch of people saying that when oil was at $140 a barrel, it represented a, you know, good free market price equilibrium. There were no speculative elements in there. And I contend then, contend now, that anybody that thinks that you can find practically any market that's in full price equilibrium, that's a classroom concept. You know, to think that happens in the real world, to find full price equilibrium in the real world is about as easy to spot as a neutrino. And I think there was, you know, major speculative, you know, demand for oil by hedge funds and institutional investors that pushed oil prices through the futures markets to these unbelievably high levels that were completely unrealistic and did some major damage to the global economy. And now I certainly hope that OPEC is unable to control the price declines, because I'd like to see them fall a lot further.
Well, the International Monetary Fund reported, I think earlier this morning, or maybe it was yesterday, that Iran needs or requires oil to average $90 a barrel this year to avoid deficit spending. Bahrain requires $75 a barrel, and Oman is $77 a barrel. Iraq says it needs to have at least $111 a barrel. The balance is booked this year, and it's trying to figure out ways to cut their spending. So therefore, we keep hearing on the political shows that Iraq has its $80 billion. You know, that they ought to be spending that for themselves. It appears to me if they've got to make $111 a barrel just to balance its books, and right now it's selling for what, approximately $74-$75 a barrel, they got a problem. And will that become?
Hey, Raymond, you're breaking my heart.
I can hear that.
You're really breaking my heart. I am so sad for Iran. I am so sad. You know, actually, the folks in Bahrain are pretty nice, but I'm not sad for them either. And I'm sorry. I can
feel your tears, Lincoln. I can feel them.
I am crying for Venezuela. Chavez is one of my near and dear friends.
I'm being
totally sarcastic here.
I do have a question regarding the way Greenspan ran, you know, the Federal Reserve Board. He always kind of felt that the Federal Reserve Board should not try to get involved with these financial bubbles, and should leave them alone, and they should run their course and then deal with the consequences. What do you feel, or what do you think about that type of attitude, as opposed to trying to find, when they have these financial bubbles, attempt to pierce them and resolve it immediately? Which of the two ways would you feel would be the better of the two? Pierce it, resolve it, or let the financial bubble run its course and deal with the consequences?
Well, frankly, I would say that is a major league piece of sleight of hand on the part of Alan Greenspan. I don't think you should use monetary policy to go out and pierce bubbles or anything like that. I do not think that's appropriate or necessary. On the other hand, I do believe that really good regulatory policies are a great way to get at a lot of the bubble behavior. And that is where I think, to some extent, was lacking in the the tech bubble.
Mm-hmm.
We had, you know, really poor, to put it mildly, financial reporting, and we had a bunch of people who didn't know, under laws back then, weren't going to go to jail
mm-hmm.
for their lying and cheating on their income statement and balance sheet reporting
mm-hmm.
that, you know, created part of the problem. And then in the current go-round, you know, a massive regulatory failure, especially in the mortgage market, but also, you know, his and others' complete opposition to having an open exchange and regulated process in the credit derivative swaps marketplace
mm-hmm.
is certainly, in retrospect, a serious error. And, you know, the Federal Reserve being one of the principal regulators of the commercial banking system, I think was, from a regulatory perspective, bears a good deal of the blame on the, you know, on this in this process, you know,
mm-hmm.
as well as other regulatory bodies. So I think a better regulatory environment can help on the bubbles front much better than sort of trying to pierce it with monetary policy.
Mm-hmm. I did want to go back to just because our time is going to be up fairly soon, and I did want to go ahead and talk about that European Central Bank that we didn't quite get into. What exactly is the European Central Bank?
That's a great question, and it's really an important one because it's part of my concern about Europe. Is the European Central Bank is, as Jean-Claude Trichet, the fellow who's running it right
mm-hmm.
now, who's the chairman, repeatedly says, is not a lender of last resort, unlike the Federal Reserve, which is a lender
mm-hmm.
of last resort. So if banks in, say, Italy or Spain or whatever country in that's part of the Eurozone
mm-hmm.
Come under pressure, it is not the ECB's responsibility to fire up the printing presses and print lots of money and bail out all their problems,
mm-hmm.
whereas it is in the United States. Indirectly, I'm oversimplifying here to some extent,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, for example, even when we ran up the inflation rate enormously in the mid to late 1970s, U.S. government debt was still AAA.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we may have been inflating away the value of that debt, but it was still AAA. In Europe, you now have significant divergences in country debt ratings that could get a lot worse in fairly short order. So countries that are experiencing significant difficulties, and they're using fiscal policy because they don't really have monetary policy to attack the problem,
okay.
You know, to bail out banks and do that sort of stuff, could see
mm-hmm.
significant downgrades in their sovereign debt. And when that occurs, you know, where do you go to get, you can't fire up the printing press anymore. So it creates some, you know, some potentially serious strains in Europe that are ameliorated in the U.S. Now, we pay a price because we'll end up, if you fire up the printing press, with more inflation, but at least you don't have, rapid rises in default risk.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I know this is extreme, and I'd be very surprised if it happened, but it's not impossible to consider the notion that some countries might pull out of the euro if the pressure gets
really
intense and go back to saying, oh, I'd like to have my own central bank and my own printing press, thank you very much, and I see you guys later. That's not impossible. So, you know, the ECB has by no means the same, lender of last resort and
mm-hmm.
Powers that the Federal Reserve has.
Well, what do you think of the Federal Reserve committing such large sums of money to the European Central Bank?
Oh, I think it's money good. I mean, these are swap agreements, so I think those funds will come back over time. I have no reason to suspect, I suppose it's possible, but I really, really, really doubt it, that the
mm-hmm.
European Central Bank's, not able to meet its swap agreements.
During the National Conference at LPL, there was a speaker by the name of Nassim Nicholas Taleb. He wrote that book called The Black Swan.
Mm-hmm.
And on page 43 of his book, he talks about three things that did concern me, I think concern me especially now. And I think we alluded to this earlier in our conversation. First, in the year 1982, you know, when all those banks failed because due to their lending to the South and Central American countries, it caused those countries to default at the same time. And at that time, the Federal Reserve Board described that as an event of an exceptional nature. All the while, the bankers led everyone to believe that the banks were very conservative, and that was in 1982. The next concern was reference to a collapse during the 1990s in the scene of the savings and loans that caused the federal bailout, what, of $500 billion?
Well, I wouldn't call that a bailout. It was, you know, they folded up those savings loans. They took over their assets in the Resolution Trust Corp, but all the shareholders and debt holders of those SNLs, they got zero.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, it wasn't a bailout.
And what about the long-term capital management that was run by those Nobel Prize winners? You know, where they caused that financial calamity that almost overturned our financial markets. I thought that the Federal Reserve Board protected these three financial occurrences at our expense, or am I wrong?
Well, yeah, to some extent. Like I say, the SNLs did not get bailed out. They got busted, sent to shareholders and debt holders, got nothing. The assets went tooling over to the Resolution Trust Corp, where they were sold for, you know, a lot less than what they were being carried on the SNL's books for. So in that sense, there were taxpayer losses, but it was not a bailout. And, you know, there were serious losses in long-term capital, as I recall, as well. But, you know, to some extent, you could conceivably call that a bailout. And, you know, back in the early 80s, there were a few banks that were protected under the too big to fail doctrine. And, you know, there are some now, which is one of the reasons for my antipathy to the very large deposit-insured commercial bank is, you know, is precisely for that reason. So, you know, there is certainly a case to be made here that, you know, that when you get these kinds of bailouts, they're always inequitable. They're always, you know, ugly and unfair and unjustified, and you will always see prominent examples of people who shouldn't be getting golden parachutes getting them, and, you know, junkets to Scotland to shoot partridges that should not be happening. And,
what did you think when you heard that on the news? That this
appalled.
Is what they were doing.
You should be all appalled at stuff like that. I mean, it's just like
it was unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. And so, you know, and so the statement of, you know, that, you know, you end up with, when things go well, you know, folks make, you know, in these institutions make a lot of money, and when things go badly, we taxpayers end up bearing the cost. To some extent, that's true. But I think, you know, in the new financial system we are going to construct in the wake of this unprecedented financial market meltdown we're going through will be, you know, like I said, it'll have pluses and minuses, big pluses and minuses. On balance, I think it'll be a better system in that this kind of unregulated risk-taking that I've been talking about here and in other parts of the financial system, for better or for worse, and I think on balance for better, will go away.
Lincoln, before we sign off, what do you want to tell the average investor out here in America? What's your recommendation during these days?
My recommendation is have faith. I mean, we do have a very strong, very diversified economy. Yeah, it has been and is going to be laid low for some time by some just horrendous mistakes in the financial system, but it does not mean our economy is broken, not by any means. We have just, you know, the vast number of non-financial corporations and small businesses and even small banks out there are doing, you know, or have been and will continue to do just fine.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't like we're going to, you know, have their sales wiped out or, you know, investment opportunities go away. We're just going to go through a really rough patch here. And it's just important to bear in mind that in the main, these are great big paper losses. It isn't like we've had, you know, 15 Katrinas hit our country all at once. That is
mm-hmm.
not what's happened here.
So your recommendation to the average investor is?
It's fear in a nice, balanced, diversified portfolio. Hang tough. If you have big overweights and a lot of risky assets, you know, it's always makes case to pare back, though this is a tough time to do it. If you were very much underweight, risky assets, and sitting there in cash, consider doing that. And I'm always very much a cranky contrarian. If you've been in these really hot outperforming asset classes for the last 7 years, you know, owned a lot of energy stocks or material stocks or, you know, international or, you know, emerging markets, you know,
mm-hmm.
well, emerging markets is probably too late. But think about, you know, paring back on those and moving into out of favor asset classes.
Mm-hmm.
If you were lucky enough to own a boatload of U.S. Treasury securities, I'd think about lightening up there and buying some more risky fixed income securities. The municipal debt market is, in my opinion, on sale, for example.
It sounds to me, Lincoln, that you have a great faith in the American society and the American industry and the American people in general. We're going to pick up our broken marbles here and put them all back together and have a better day sometime in the near future. I hope so.
Yeah, we've done it over and over again. We'll do it
mm-hmm.
again.
Mm-hmm. Well, before I sign you off, is there anything else that you want to say that you said, you know, I do want to drive this home, you know, for the investors who are listening and our audience. Is there anything else you want to add to it, or is this the end right here?
Oh boy, you've got me talked out.
Lincoln, it's been an absolute delight having you here. You've
thank
been delightful.
You,
you've been informative, and I've dragged you through some pretty good questions, and I truly appreciate that. And you know, I think the highest of you. I've known you for, I think about 10, 15 years, whatever it turns out to be. And you always give some wonderful answers, and I truly enjoy having you as a friend, and I've known you all these years. Lincoln, thank you again.
Thank you. Thank you
very and much. A good night, and I appreciate your generosity in taking the time to be with our station. So, again, this is Syndicated News. I'm Raymond F. Rivas, the Chief Financial Editor. Our firm is Atherton Wealth Planning. You've been listening to Mr. Lincoln Anderson, one of the best economists in probably in the world as far as I know. And we want to thank you again for listening to our broadcast. And until Thursday, when my guest is going to be Mr. Charles Day in the area of defined benefit plans, which is a completely different way of thinking about how to invest. Again, I want to thank my guest, Mr. Lincoln Anderson, and good night. And it's been a real pleasure, Lincoln. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
He said something once I never will forget. He said love is like a blindfold, it's shot in the dark. Girl, when I met you, I was back to the wall. With one last round and I shot it straight from the heart. And I saw a spark. I saw a spark. Something else once I never will forget. I'm just a boy, and stay with me. She said, if you got something good, you got to hold on to it. So darling, won't you please come and stay with me and be my star. And be my star. But he said something else once, I almost did forget. He said, man, I can't help it. See the woods for the trees. Once upon a time, babe, I felt like that. These days your light shines always in me, inside my heart. Inside my heart. Darling, won't you be my silver spark? Oh, when I'm I want to say something, hope you never will forget. Wherever you are, and wherever I may be, as lost as I may seem, as cold as it may get, as old as we may be,